French occupation, entailing the human losses of over a million martyrs. The Algerians in particular stand so steadfast in support of the Palestinian cause.
Algerian fans exploding with support for Palestine in a football match. But this footage is not from the iconic Algerian victory of Tunisia in the FIFA Arab Cup recently. These scenes were taken from a friendly between Algeria and Palestine in 2016. With 70,000 attending the match, Algerians were widely cheering in support of the Palestinian side, scoring against their own country. At a time when neighboring Kingdom of Morocco and numerous Persian Gulf monarchies have normalized relations with the Israeli regime, 99% of Algerians still oppose any recognition of the settler colonial enterprise. This is reflected by the Algerian government, who has consistently refused any form of diplomatic relations with the Israeli regime. The imprint on the Algerian psyche of French occupation and settler colonialism cannot be understated. Between the two people, there is a shared understanding of what it means to be deprived of self-determination. Even generations of Algerians born post-independence have a keen appreciation of what it means to fight for your freedom against racist settler colonial rule. The journey Algerians walked informed their foreign policy once independent, and this special affinity with occupied people was articulated in the granting of the Palestinian Liberation Organization an office in Algiers not long after the French colonizers left. It is no coincidence that the PLO chose Algiers as the site from which to announce the establishment of the Palestinian state in 1988. Fast forward to December 2021, we saw a delegation from the Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement, Hamas, meet with representatives of the government in Algeria and thank them for the many decades of support. From the macro to the micro, we see the solidarity shine brightly with Palestinian protesters in the West Bank village of Burqa, raising the Algerian flag in the midst of a confrontation with the Israeli occupation forces. This Palestinian protester echoes the words of former Algerian president Houari Boumediene verbatim when he said, "We are with the Palestinians, whether they are the oppressed or the oppressor."
Algeria is always in our hearts. I am with Palestine, whether oppressed or oppressing. Wherever it goes, the flag of Algeria is with Palestine. We are with Algeria, always and forever. Algeria, in my opinion, is like Palestine, even better. Algeria and Palestine are the same thing. There's no difference between them.
What is it that ties Algerians so strongly to Palestinians? Why are Algerians and Palestinians reaching so strongly in each other's direction while other Arab rulers and neighbors are openly embracing the Israeli regime?
To discuss the issue of Palestinian solidarity in the Arab world, we have two esteemed guests joining us today. David Miller is an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He recently was invited to Tunisia by the Palestine Solidarity Movement and was given an award by the local mayor in appreciation of his exceptional defense of Palestinian rights. And Dr. Ghada Karmi is a Palestinian author and academic. She's written an autobiography about her life titled In Search of Fatima, a Palestinian story. She writes frequently on Palestinian issues in newspapers and magazines, and she's a former fellow and lecturer at the Institute of Arab and Islamic Studies at the University of Exeter. Thank you very much for joining us today, to both of you. I'm going to come straight to you, David, because congratulations are in order. You've received an award in Tunisia for your brave work, if I may say so, for the Palestinian cause. Could you just tell us what it's like over there? We're going to be discussing Tunisia as well as Algeria. What's the situation like in Tunisia in regards to the Palestinian cause?
Well, when I was there, it was the anniversary of the revolution. And, I attended the demonstration in commemoration of the revolution. And, of course, at that demonstration, there were many Palestinian flags. There is a very strong sense in the population of Tunisia of solidarity with the Palestinian struggle. And that remains the case. Of course, that's not always reflected in the views and activities of the government of Tunisia, which sometimes seems to be thinking about normalization. There's been a huge debate, public debate there, about trying to outlaw normalization in law, and that's been a problematic thing. I myself, when we were there, was stopped by undercover police for having committed the sin of having a Palestinian flag near a government building. So you can see the kind of tension that there is there.
Yes.
Only 2 years ago, the Tunisian ambassador to the United Nations was dismissed because he was too pro-Palestinian. So there is clearly a tension there, but there's a very strong solidarity movement amongst the people of Tunisia.
Wow, and I want to come to you, Doctor, because obviously you're a very well-known, outspoken Palestinian voice here in the UK, and you have many years of experience. You were a child at the time of the Nakba, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. Before I ask you about your thoughts on the strong support for Palestine in certain countries, whilst others are abandoning that, could you just tell us a little bit about what it was like being a child, your memories of the Nakba?
What can I tell you, except that it was a deeply traumatizing experience, which has remained with me all my life. One has to only imagine that I was a child who was at elementary school, primary school, and we lived in West Jerusalem, which is where the Zionists tried to establish themselves early on. There was, this is before May 1948, by the way. From January 1948 onwards, there was literally a campaign of terror, and it was designed to get people to leave. The forced expulsions were taking place in many villages and so on, but in Jerusalem, it was designed really to terrorize us into leaving. All I can remember is fear, not my own so much, but my parents. I didn't understand why, but I just knew that we had to leave. I didn't know why. I lost everything. Overnight, we took refuge in Syria initially. Overnight, in the taxi, my whole world vanished. That's the best way I can describe it.
And, of course, right now we're going through a trend of normalisation. So much of the Arab world, the political leadership of the Arab world, is beginning to normalise relations with Israel, something which I don't believe we would have even imagined would have happened, let's say, 10, 20 years ago. What do you make of all that? How does that make you feel to see this happening in front of you?
Well, first of all, as always, with regard to the Arabs and Palestine, we need to remember that there's a distinction to be made, which David has already alluded to, between the peoples, the population, and the governments. The populations, and particularly of North Africa, are very sympathetic, very supportive of the Palestinians, heroically so in the case of Algeria. Yeah. But the governments of most of these countries have been persuaded that their best futures lie with the West, and particularly with the United States. So one also has to understand that the normalization, so-called, of Arab governments is a proxy for pleasing the United States. Because, they used to say in women's magazines that the way to a man's heart went through his stomach. Yeah. Well, the way to the American's heart is through Israel. So that's the lesson they've all learned. And I think it has to be understood like that. But if you ask me how do I feel, it's absolutely despicable. What can I say? This entity, Israel, which is really toxic, it's a really dangerous state, which means no good to any of the Arabs, however nice they are to it. How can so many Arab governments get it wrong? They don't seem to understand what Israel is really about. If they did, they would never dream of having relations with it.
David, I'm going to come back to you and bring in some of your expertise, perhaps, on the countries that are showing much more strength in supporting the Palestinian cause, despite the normalization trend. Algeria specifically, I think it's an interesting coincidence that they too, Tunisia as well, if I'm not mistaken, suffered for many, many years under Western imperialism and a colonialist project that went on there for many years. Perhaps you could bring us a little bit of examples of what they had to put up with. And do you think that that has something to do with the fact that so many in Algeria and Tunisia remain so loyal to the Palestinian cause because they see a comparison between their history and the Palestinians' history?
Well, it certainly is the case that those parallels have marked the experience of those countries, especially in Algeria. I mean, the experience of Algeria was of a settler colonial French presence in Algeria, which is, you know, very analogous to the settler colonial state of Israel. And people see that. It's not just that they see the analogy, but they also see the connections that there were between the resistance to colonialism in Algeria, the FLN, and the resistance has been to Israel's actions and its occupation of Palestine. So the in fact, it's also the case that the Israelis were involved in the Algerian struggle to some extent. The Mossad had created an organization inside Algeria, indeed in Tunisia, which was involved in armed struggle, i.e. terrorism, and was in alliance with the OAS, the secret army.
We are going to discuss that very point later on in the show. Before we get into that very interesting aspect of what's happened in the north, I want to bring some more statistics about what's actually been happening to the Algerians in the past. So I've got some estimates here reaching as far as 3.5 million Algerians being resettled by the French during their occupation of that country, which would have been around 50% of the rural population at the time. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's been predicted that millions were killed in the subsequent conflict, which happened when the Algerians tried to fight for their freedom and so on. And this rings very familiar to the numbers that we see out of Palestine. So again, David, if you want to go into that a little bit more about the what they put up with.
When the French first occupied Algeria in 1830, they regarded the Muslims and the Jews as being natives who had a subsidiary status, who didn't have the status of Europeans, who had different rights and laws. But subsequently, the French decided that the Jews would have a higher status. And in 1870, they accorded the Jews in Algeria full French citizenship, so that subsequently the Jews had more rights, at least in the north of the country, not in the south of the country, but in the north of the country, than did
some kind
Muslims.
Of divide and rule
so there,
policy.
There was a policy there which had the result in the end that many people in the Jewish community became not just pro-Israel, but also in favour of colonialism, in favour of the terrorist acts that were committed in the civil war, in the anti-colonial struggle, and that has had a fundamental impact on even today on the way in which French Jews who've come from North Africa can their politics. I mean, you will look only today to the case of Eric Zemmour, who is from Algeria, and who's a candidate in the presidential election this year, and who sees himself as a pied noir, as a colonist from Algeria, although, of course, you know, Jewish communities went back to the first century in Algeria. They were natives. They weren't colonists.
Now, we are going to change the direction slightly in this next piece on the show. We're going to be bringing it back over here to the UK, where normalisation is also an issue. A group that claims to represent the interests of Shia Muslims in Scotland has caused major upset after its Secretary General has been recorded sharing a platform with numerous pro-Israel faith leaders. However, the Scottish Ahlbayt Society is not the only Muslim group that rubs shoulders with Zionists. The problem is much more widespread and has been ongoing for many years. An agenda of Israeli normalisation in the British interfaith community has been something which has been complained about for a long, long time. But does this type of initiative compromise the global Muslim boycott of Israel? Well, I went out and spoke to some experts to find out more. In recent years, a new faith-based initiative has become very popular in Britain. Interfaith work, which sees faith leaders rubbing shoulders with other religious groups. The purpose, to bring communities together and combat extremism. But everything isn't all it seems. Concern is steadily growing amid rising accusations that pro-Israel groups and activists are using this harmony-promoting scheme to push an agenda of normalisation with Zionism within the British Muslim community.
Ever since the colonialist project in Palestine began, the Islamic world has taken a strict anti-Zionism stance, with all the major scholars banning Muslims from supporting Israel in any way. However, interfaith schemes such as these might be trying to change all that.
Hi and welcome to World.
A recent example took place in December last year. An online podcast series titled A World of Faith was hosted by the Director General of the Scottish Athelbait Society based in Edinburgh, Sayed Ali Abbas Razawi. As part of the series, Mr. Razawi platformed two rabbis, both known supporters of Israel, including Rabbi David Rosen, who was hailed by Israeli press in 2020 for being the first Israeli rabbi to meet Saudi King Salman in Riyadh. Over the years, Mr. Razawi has met with many Zionist faith leaders, while his society's website claims that one of their main responsibilities is working to meet the needs of Scottish Shia Muslims. But does their breach of the mainstream Islamic boycott of Israel contradict that?
I would say majority, 99%, I could say, of the Shia scholars and ulama believe that Israel is an occupied regime. I mean, it has occupied the Palestine, and they don't have the right to govern and rule the area, and the Palestine should be returned to the Palestinians.
At the first stage, he shouldn't be convinced to do it if he's a scholar. This person will know exactly in his heart and his mind what is the right thing to do. The current history of what's happening now to the Palestinian, which is he knows. As a scholar, as a person who's following up of the news of his Muslim brothers in Syria, in Palestine, in Libya, in Egypt, in all that, he will be aware of what's happening in Palestine by the anti-Zionist. He will tell me, no, this is interfaith group, they don't believe, they are not pro-Zionist and all that. I would tell him then, how can you prove it? Who they belong to?
We reached out to the Scottish Athelbait Society with a list of issues raised. They decided not to respond. Mr. Razawi is a repeat offender. However, he isn't the only Muslim happy to interact with Zionists. Other examples can be found going back years, many involving mosques, charities, and others who call themselves Muslim scholars. Robert Carter, Palestine Declassified.
So a controversial tactic which has caused upset amongst many. Doctor, I'm going to come straight to you on this. What's your opinion about all this as a Palestinian, as someone who's worked to defend the cause for many, many years, when you see others who are supposed to be supporting the initiative for Palestine, rubbing shoulders with Zionists, being very pally, very friendly, possibly getting a lot of perks out of this initiative themselves? How does that make you feel? What do you think?
Look, these so-called interfaith dialogue industry, really, I can only call it that, has been going on for quite a long time. And it's another of the ways in which Zionism, which is a political ideology we must never forget, has tried to infiltrate all kinds of arenas and get itself normalized so that the narrative of the Zionists becomes familiar and people accept it, and they work very hard. I have to hand it to them, you know. But this arena of interfaith understanding, dialogue, etc., should be exposed for what it is. It's precisely a vehicle being exploited by the Zionists in order to promote the cause of Israel. Sadly, though, I have to say that a number of Muslims and Christians fall for this stuff. They're not themselves prejudiced, evil, ill-intentioned at all. On the contrary, they're well-meaning people who want to advance the cause of harmony and peace. But they do not understand this business with the Zionists. And as a result, they fall in with these ideas and give them respectability. It infuriates me, really, because, you see, it's very clever of the Zionists, because if you come out against well-meaning religious people with everybody associates with kindness and benevolence, and you come out, you look very bad. whereas we know very well they're being exploited.
David, I'm going to come back to you to bring us back to the point you were making earlier in the show, and I'd like to give you a chance to expand on that. In North Africa, you can correct me if I get this wrong, there were Israeli activities in the region going back many, many years in order to support the imperialist occupation of those countries, including the French. I'll pass it on to you. You can explain it much better than I can.
There was an organization called the Misgaret, which was set up by Mossad, both in Algeria and Tunisia, on the one hand, and later in Morocco.
What year are we looking at here? What decade?
We're looking in the
1950s. 1950s, okay. Yeah.
And the Misgaret was involved in the decolonization struggle on the side of the French. And indeed, was involved in setting up arms caches, and there's a recorded instance, according to Zionist sources, where they actually opened fire on FLN guerrillas and killed them.
So the Israeli intelligence we're referring to here, attacking.
The organization they set up was engaged in attacking and killed FLN guerrillas. And many of the people who were involved in this organization were aligned with the organization Armée Secrète, which is the death squad operation run by French colonists to resist decolonization. So there was a very strong relationship there between an organization set up directly by the Mossad, which was engaged in trying to stop the anti-colonial struggle. Now, in Tunisia, they had a similar organization, no recorded deaths in relation to that. But in Morocco, the interesting contrast is that they didn't have to do that kind of activity, military activity. They instead infiltrated the security services of King Hassan, and they were able to use that to pursue their plans to remove children from Morocco, which they did on a secret mission, taking them out of the country, then eventually taking them to Israel, against the policies of the government and against, indeed, the attempts by the Moroccan police to stop this. This was sabotaged by their contacts in the Moroccan secret services, who they subsequently did a deal with, and they reshaped the Moroccan secret services, this is Mossad, in order to be more friendly to Israel. So that's part of the reason why you have a much more friendly relationship between Morocco and Israel, and this is going back many decades now, than you have in Tunisia and in Algeria. So this is an ongoing process where the objectives of Israeli foreign policy is to undermine any government which will oppose it, and that's the case in Tunisia, and that's the case also in Algeria.
To you both, it's been an absolute pleasure and an honour to have you both on the show. We are out of time, unfortunately. I know, David, you'll be coming back very soon so we can continue our talk, and you're the first Palestinian we've had on the show since we've launched Doctor, so it's an absolute pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for your time. That is, unfortunately, all the time we have for this edition of the show. Thanks for joining us. We will be back next time with more news and analysis from Palestine on this show, Palestine Declassified. I've been Robert Carter, and it's bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's advice on those clergy and quasi-clergy who are unaware of Islam, but try to portray the capitalist and socialist economic models. In this episode, we are going to touch upon other parts of his testament in which he warns the clergy against being affected by rumors of those who are ill-wishers and enemies of the Islamic system. Stay tuned, please. When Imam Khomeini started his revolution in early 1960s, some of the ulema were opposed to him, even warned him of struggles against the regime of Shah. However, with the spread of the revolution, little by little, more ulema joined him. Nevertheless, a small number of these ulema continued opposing the Imam. During the first years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution and establishment of the new system of government, Iran faced myriads of internal and external problems. These included the moves of the remnants of the royal system, efforts of separatists to damage national unity through creation of riots here and there, and most importantly, the plots of external enemies to overthrow the system, or at least to fully render it inefficient. The all-out Iraqi war in 1980s was the climax of these plots. Imam Khomeini writes in his testament to those who kept finding fault with the Islamic system instead of helping it through giving solutions, "I recommend to those who, due to some mistakes, intentionally or unintentionally, are strongly opposed to the Islamic Republic itself, and for God's sake, are active to overthrow it, thinking that this republic is worse than or the same as the royal regime, just to ponder honestly in their solitude and fairly compare it with the former rule and regime. Besides, they should pay attention that chaos, mistakes, and opportunism are inevitable in revolutions in the world." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, enumerates some problems facing the Islamic Republic system, such as the internal and external conspiracies, armed assaults, infiltration of corrupt elements in various government establishments, etc., and advises the ulema not to be deceived by media hype and rumors. He writes, "You should pay attention and consider the hardships of this republic, including plots, false propaganda, armed attack from outside and inside, inevitable infiltration of some corrupt groups and opponents of Islam in all government centers to make people discontent with Islam and the Islamic rule, being inexperienced of most or many of the authorities, spread of false rumors by those who have been denied or receive little illegitimate benefits, considerable shortage of judges and backbreaking economic problems, shortage of skilled and expert righteous people, and scores of other problems. Which one will be unaware of them unless being in the scene, in addition to those super capitalist persons who are proponents of the royal system and through ushery, profiteering, immense overcharging, smuggling and hoarding, have pressured the destitute and deprived in the society to the extent of perishing and have been causing corruption in society. I humbly advise the respectable ulama not to be affected by these rumors and strengthen this republic for the sake of God and preservation of Islam. Imam Khomeini advises those who are hell-bent on toppling the Islamic Republic system that once this system is toppled, the substitute will be a regime that will be the flunky of either the West or the East. He writes in his testament, "The respectable ulama should know that if this Islamic Republic fails, it won't be replaced by an Islamic regime which is intended by Imam Mahdi, or one which is obedient to you. It a regime will be take power, which is intended by one of the poles of power, and the deprived of the world, who have enthusiastically turned toward Islam and the Islamic rule, will be disappointed, and Islam will be isolated forever. And you will regret your acts when the die is cast, and there is no use in regretting. If you expect everything to change overnight, according to Islam and the laws of Almighty God, it is a mistake. Such a thing has not happened and will not happen throughout the human history. And on the day that, God willing, the absolute reformer, Imam Mahdi, will emerge, you should not think that there will be a miracle and the world will be reformed in one day. Rather, the oppressors will be suppressed and isolated through efforts and self-sacrifices.
He who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. A simple question.
Does it matter who owns English football clubs? Police are investigating a graphic banner displayed by Crystal Palace fans that targeted the Saudi Arabian takeover of Newcastle United. That banner focused on the Premier League's ownership test following Newcastle United's £305 million sale. It featured illustrations of a man dressed in Arabic clothing, alongside what appears to be chief executive of the Premier League, Richard Masters. The sign listed offences the regime is accused of by human rights groups: terrorism, beheading, civil rights abuses, murder, censorship and persecution, which were all ticked off on a clipboard under the heading Premier League Owners Test. The Premier League's chief executive, Richard Masters, was also depicted giving a thumbs up to a bag of cash, standing in a pool of blood. Palace fan group Homesdale Fanatics has said it created the banner, which was shown during a recent football match. An accompanying statement said,
To give the thumbs up to this deal at a time when the Premier League is promoting inclusive initiatives shows the total hypocrisy at play and demonstrates the league's soulless agenda where profits trump all. Although the Premier League said it had received legal assurances from the new owners that the Saudi state would not control Newcastle United and there would be penalties if this is not true, others doubt this to be the case. While the impact of these huge investments has been league success, for example for Manchester City, thanks to Abu Dhabi investment money, there are claims that these massive money ventures are designed to create a positive impact for the image of wealthy Middle East dictators.
What does the public think of Saudi ownership of English football clubs? And why are these states so eager to buy British clubs in this way? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. What does the public here in North London make of Saudi Arabia's human rights record? And do they even care? That's what we asked. Here's what they said.
I've not heard anything. I've heard of Saudi Arabia, but I know nothing about that.
I'm not an expert, but from what I've heard, at least on the women's rights side of things, it's pretty poor. It's pretty poor. Listening to the news, I think probably they're taking small steps as a kind of show to like, oh, look, we're doing this, but in reality, it's not good.
To be honest, I don't actually know a lot about that. That's something that hasn't really come up on my radar. I haven't got a clue, to be honest. I really don't have anything to say about that.
I mean, the thing about Saudi Arabia is they obviously have made some changes, things like, you know, the last few years, women being able to drive, other things, but there's a lot that still continues to be sort of hidden and under the surface, and some of their arms deals, for example, with Yemen and other things. You know, there are clearly a lot of things going on, not all of which... I mean, most things don't make the news and most things aren't very public, so...
I just know that it's appalling. Yes, that's all.
I can't say I've ever actually thought about it. Maybe I should. And probably after this interview, I'll go on my phone and do some Googling.
Not a good record. I've supported Amnesty International for many years, written quite a few letters about Saudi Arabia's record on this subject, so, no.
I'm concerned about it, because it's not very good, as I understand it. I don't know enough about it to go into detail, but, yeah, so, yes, I am concerned about it.
I think it's poor, and I think giving them the opportunity to use the Premier League to kind of wash it out is a bad thing.
I wouldn't say that I'm, you know, terribly knowledgeable about it, but I know that they have the death penalty and not much else. I know that their sort of leader was accused of the murder of a journalist recently, and that's about all. I don't think they've got great rights for women, would be my impression, but I'm not an expert on it at all.
No, at all. Yeah, it's not at all. Saudi Arabia is good. Good country, it's Muslim country, and it's good. And I don't know, I never heard any problem in Saudi Arabia. They're good, yeah.
I care about it because where I'm from as well, because I wasn't born here. So I'm in that part of the world where it's money talks, isn't it? That's all it is, it's just money. You know, I don't think they should be there anyway, to tell you the truth. You know, what should they?
What does the public think of Saudi-related state interests purchasing Newcastle United Football Club?
I mean, I think in general it's just sad how, rich owners are just, you know, buying clubs. It feels like there's not really that closeness with fans anymore. You know, they're different, just in a world of their own, just buying success. And, yeah, I think that is sad, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes people say that sport shouldn't be political, but I think that's a, you know, they're making a quite a big statement. I think they've also own quite a lot of other property and other things, don't they? It's not just the football club, various things that they own. I don't really know what it's about, but I suppose it's having, gaining influence in various different countries and making agreements in order to make better trade deals, and a lot of it's about arms as well. So, yeah, it's not great.
I'm a huge football fan. I'm obviously a Gooner because of the area I live in. I kind of sort of disagree with the amount of money in football in general. I think it should be a bit more like fantasy football, where you have a certain amount of money that's capped and each team then has a set amount of money, because then it's fair. And then also the game is not about just the players, it's back about the sport. Whereas at the moment I feel like football is now just about how much money can one team spend on one player, and it becomes about an individual contest instead of the team sport. So I think, you know, I don't think there's a problem with like Saudi Arabia or other kind of countries buying up football, because it's a global sport and it kind of spreads awareness of the Premier League and stuff. But I sort of disagree with the whole money aspects of the sport, really.
I've got very strong feelings about it. I'm aware of it, and worried about, you know, a country like Saudi Arabia infiltrating our sport. But, you know, sport is business, is money, isn't it? I mean, football is capitalism with a capital C, really, isn't it? So, yeah, I mean, sad but true.
I think it's gross. Like, and I think if you look at the amount of dirty money that's in UK politics and UK sport, especially football, it's not a good thing.
I'm a football fan myself. It's a bit tragic how they bought Newcastle Football Club. Surely Newcastle fans will disagree with me. If they look at their track record, I think it's quite concerning.
Well, they have money. That's why they bought that, that big team. Yeah, that's good. That's good. They get money for that.
I guess it's a bit of a kick in the teeth. But I mean, I believe in like trade between different countries, and I don't believe in Brexit, so I'm not like in favour of not trading with other countries.
I think it's just dirty business of Saudi sheikhs, like, let's say this, and it can be related some money laundering or something like that. In my opinion, I think this. And as you know, that the papers, Pandora Papers, is maybe it's just related each other's.
I don't particularly like the fact that all the Premiership football clubs are owned now, you know, by people who seem to run them for profit rather than, you know, sort of the true fan base. So. Slightly disapproving view from that point of view. Obviously, from what you were touching on, their human rights record, that rings alarm bells as well. So, overall, not a fan, like, you know, I guess.
I mean, as long as it keeps the clubs running, I guess. That's quite good, I think. I'm not a pro, to be fair. Yeah, I think that could be great.
Deep down, I'm not really bothered. But it shouldn't be them, you know, because they're taking over. Not in a bad way, I don't mean in a bad way, but it shows you money talks. It's all about money. He sold it for 300,000, 300 million, and look how much they're going to invest. But the fans want it, you know, and that's it. It shows you at Crystal Palace with the banner, all the things they've done. They've highlighted it, didn't they? You know, that's it, really. I mean, I don't know what else. What else do you want to know?
Football commentator Gary Neville has argued that Saudi Arabia's ownership of a British football club means that they're more likely to listen to human rights concerns, and that this could lead to an improvement in their human rights record. Does the public agree?
There's too much money in football to think that people would discover a conscience.
Not actually, because it's different things, yeah. But it can be some illegal things, I believe, because it's not easy to prove the source of money.
I mean, I'm not sure. I'm not really sure. Because obviously my life is completely different from these people who are able to financially buy a football club, so I wouldn't... It's not the same life, I would say.
I don't know. Their human rights is bad. So at the end of the day, I'm not the one who makes the decision. You know, the FA should know better and the Premier should know better. But they must have went for it, didn't they? You know, the Premiership allowed it, you know, but they don't really care either. It brings money into the Premiership, doesn't it?
I think you have to respect Gary Neville, who knows his football. I think sport has can have an impact on politics and for the good, but it's a bit of a tall order, isn't it?
I mean, I think it's wishful thinking. I don't think they're going to change the way that they treat people in that country because they bought Newcastle United. I don't see that happening.
I don't think it's going to make a difference. I mean, this is like a bit of fun for them, a bit of petty cash. I don't think buying a football team here is going to make any difference to human rights in Saudi Arabia.
I think the FA should have made a private inquiry about the takeover as well, the background of it, really. But it's sad that not many English-owning football clubs around the Premier League. And I think the FA should act the pound it, and I think Phil Neville honestly should keep his comment to himself.
Well, who knows? Saudi Arabia is bad. It's, I don't know. We're just people talk, say it's that bad, that good. I don't think so. That is a businessman who buy the... It's not about good country or not.
No, I wouldn't follow that school of thought. I like Gary Neville, like, and he's quite funny, but no, I don't think I would agree with him on that.
Completely different thing. I mean, it's the same with in many different countries where you hope that having some influence over human rights for being investing in that country or developing that country, but actually it doesn't work out like that. Yeah, no, I don't believe that argument.
On first thought, no. I think that seems a little bit optimistic. I think that the fact that they've bought a club, frankly, won't make a difference to that.
A quick look at the financial statistics tells the story. The Newcastle United deal cost its new Saudi owners £305 million. However, the money invested in just the players in Manchester City is estimated at over £1 billion. It's also estimated that 13 football clubs out of 20 in the Premier League are now wholly or mainly foreign-owned. The net worth of the Newcastle United owners is put at $250 billion.
In recent years, we've seen Saudi Arabia host British elite boxing matches, and now they've purchased a British football club. What, in the public's opinion, is behind Saudi Arabia's sudden interest in British sports?
Well, I think it goes back to, like, you know, it's about the reputation. If they can get these massive fights, the whole world's watching. You know, if they can get AJ, Usyk, Fury, it just seems like that's the place to be. There's some kind of, you know, reputation, some standard there, which obviously there isn't, but that's what the money's buying, and it's a shame these sportsmen are going off and buying into it. But I think that's the main thing. It's a spectacle, getting an audience, a viewership there, making it seem like, you know, it's the place to be, but it's just money, and it comes back to money.
I guess... If I had to say something off the top of my head, it's like I said earlier, where sport is a very big part of what we do. I mean, I live in Highbury and Islington. I've lived here all my life, and I've watched, like, Arsenal matches and people streaming out of Hunt, like, thousands and thousands of people, you know, streaming out of Highbury and Islington Station, walking down Highbury Fields to go see a sports match. And so if you think about it... the perhaps reach that you could get by affecting sports matches is pretty big.
I guess England has always, and Great Britain, because we're such an old nation, we have a lot of history here, and I definitely feel that a lot of countries like to buy in to the things that we have here in Great Britain because of, like, our ancient theatre, our ancient sport, architecture, all that sort of stuff. So I feel like Saudi Arabia and other countries do like to invest in Great Britain. It makes them feel like maybe that they have more of a historical background or backing behind them. Whereas if you're a relatively new country, development-wise, you sort of don't have that richness that we have here, I think, in more of a cultural aspect of richness, not as in, like, actual richness.
I do believe it's a business warfare. It's nothing to do with military. I think it's they compete in each other in the Middle East in terms of wealth and enterprises and business. I think they're trying to buy out clubs. Qatar bought PSG. United Arab Emirates bought Man City. And now you've got Suburb bought Newcastle. And I just feel like they're trying to buy clubs to compete each other and other businesses just to compete. If they don't get on the war field, they probably get on the business terms.
Well, I suppose Saudi Arabia has always had connections with English sport. I mean, they're very, very connected with English racing. And is Sheikh Makhtoum, is he from Saudi Arabia? I can't remember. Anyway, no. I can't think that there's anything more than the kudos of owning a Premier League football club. It's the best in the world.
I think it gives a element of legitimacy to them so that they get their foot through the door for other stuff. And I think if you look at football generally, it's quite a corrupt organisation, the way that it works from grassroots all the way up to the Premier League. You know, you look at the way Qatar got the World Cup and what's happened there. It's pretty despicable, to be perfectly honest. Right.
I'm an Arsenal fan, so... You know what I mean? You know, so I've got the Americans here. And do they care? No. You know? But they've got the money, innit? Do what they want. You know, money talks. Trust me. If Viola was... No, I don't know. I work for these lot, don't I? So I don't know.
The Premier League has allowed Middle Eastern dictatorships to purchase Manchester City Football Club and now Newcastle United Football Club. Why would they allow this to happen? And what is the Premier League getting out of these arrangements?
I guess it's about who has the money to buy something, really. I guess it's not about where you're from. It's just about what I couldn't buy a football club, for example. Maybe somebody else can buy a football club. Maybe they've got more to give to that, just because you're from somewhere else. I mean, I don't see the problem. I don't see the problem. Like, is it because people here wanted to buy the football club, but then it's priced at a higher price, so it's been sold overseas to somebody who can afford more? Is that the problem?
First thing that comes to mind would be money. You know, often a lot of these clubs and whatnot are quite greedy when it comes to money, and especially the people that have lots of money tend to want more money. And I feel like I can't see any other incentive other than just for the cash. that would be my opinion on that, yeah.
Do you know something? I've got to be honest here. Saudi Arabia, they could come in and buy Newcastle. But they ain't going to take money. You could buy all the best players in the world. Doesn't mean they're going to click. They could buy them next week. Are they going to click? Your managers are coming. He might not do well. 6 months down the road, sack him, we get someone else. They could be pear-shaped. Look at Arsenal. Since Arsene Wenger's left, right, they ain't sorted themselves out. Still struggling, you know, week in, week out. I'm a sad person because I'm an Arsenal fan. But money wouldn't help it. And I think they know that as well. They could pump in so much money into the club if they wanted to, but it's not going to do nothing. You know, you could buy who you want. It doesn't mean nothing. They could go next week in January sales and buy this player, that player and that player. They might not click. And, you know, and the fans would turn on them again. You know, and they could walk out any time they want.
Injection of cash, of course. But how it will last, heaven knows. And... I mean, they had a tough enough run with, what was he called, the man who owned Sport Direct? Anyway, so they had a tough time with him. I mean, I think they're a very loyal fan base. They're called the Magpies, I think, aren't they? So, good luck, but I'd keep a very open mind on this.
Things have been pretty hopeless for a lot of these clubs, haven't they? You know, and I could see from the way that the Newcastle fans were celebrating that they're excited about it, and you know, somebody's putting a lot of money into their club, and it'll lift them and raise their stakes in the Premiership and make life more interesting. But you know, there's another side to it as well, isn't there? So
That is what Newcastle wants, right? Newcastle wants to be a powerhouse again, and that's what it will become. You know, it might not be it won't be this season. They might get relegated this season, but they will build, and they will become like a, you know, they'll get a conversation at the table like Man City have.
I think it's very strict. It's not very strict for this kind of issues because they have to put some restrictions. For example, they can ask the source of money. And actually, I don't like the English Football Association's acts for this kind of issues?
I just think it's in terms of generating revenue, isn't it? And the Middle East is very big on the Premier League, especially the world and globally as well. And if you cut off ties with a country due to the political reasons, they're going to cut off the funding and sponsorship, really. And I think the FA, they're trying to allow that to happen, really. And I think they're there for the money.
The most recent takeover in the Premier League of Newcastle United comes after the controversial go-ahead was given for a consortium led by Saudi Arabia's State Sovereign Wealth Fund, known as the Public Investment Fund, or PIF, to take control of Newcastle United in this £300 million deal.
Middle Eastern dictatorships have the money to invest vast sums on English football clubs. But with poor human rights records, this has created a dilemma that can't be resolved by simply pointing at Premier League success. However, it seems that according to the Premier League's ownership rules, when it comes to winning on investment or winning on human rights, the investment always comes first.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight. The feud between former US President Donald Trump and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Kentucky Republican, continues to simmer as the midterm elections approach later on this year. Donald Trump has repeatedly attacked Mitch McConnell over the past year, with the criticism appearing to escalate in recent months. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Jason Lemon, writing for the Newsweek magazine. The piece is titled, Trump versus McConnell. Top Republicans fight over future of GOP.